Judges chapter 15, probably familiar character to most all of you. But we left off last time talking about Samson and killing the Philistines with a jawbone. Philistines got mad at him for burning down their fields, and they said, "Who did this to us?" When they found out it was Samson, they went to the men of Judah and said, "Give them to us or we're going to kill all of you." The men of Judah handed him over, and he said, "Look, as long as you don't hurt me, then that's fine." Well, then he broke off the ropes and began to kill the Philistines with a jawbone of a donkey that he had found laying around. Verse 14 of chapter 15, we'll pick up there. "When he came to Lehi, the Philistines shouted against him, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and the cords that were on his arms became as flax that was burnt with fire, and his bands loosed from off his hands. He found a new jawbone of an ass, and he put forth his hand and took it, and slew 1,000 men therewith. And Samson said, 'With the jawbone of an ass, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of an ass have I slain 1,000 men.'" Now, you know, we talked a little bit about the amount of exertion and effort that would take. I mean, just think about taking a bone, a stick, a pipe of any kind and swing it 1,000 times. And if he didn't kill him on the first hit every time, he had to swing it more than 1,000 times, right? Okay, it was a new jawbone of an ass. Somebody pointed out to me afterwards, you know, last time, that means it probably still had teeth in it. Okay? How new was it? I don't know. New obviously means it wasn't brittle and easily broken, but like, was it already separated from the skull? You know, did he have to separate it to use it? I have no idea. But, you know, nonetheless, God used him to kill 1,000 men with a very unusual instrument. What does that tell us? The power comes from God and not from us. Verse number 17, "It came to pass when he'd made an end of speaking that he cast away the jawbone out of his hand, and he called the name of that place Ramoth Lehi." Okay, Ramoth Lehi there, it has to do with a jawbone, like the hill of a jawbone or something like that. Verse 18, "He was sore athirst, and he called on the Lord and said, 'Thou hast given this great deliverance into the hand of thy servant, and now shall I die for thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised.'" Have you ever noticed Samson's prayers? How many of Samson's prayers sound humble and thankful? Samson's prayers sound demanding, don't they? It sounds like he's full of pride and presumption, expectancy, not in the sense of expectant faith, but in the sense of expectancy of, "You owe this to me. I don't deserve what's happening. You need to get me out of this problem." I mean, even in his prayer at the end of his life, he said, "Lord, you know, help me one more time so I can be avenged of my enemies and repay them for my eyes," and all that kind of stuff. You never see a spiritual attitude out of Samson when he prays. Even here, he said, "Lord, you gave a great deliverance, and now you're going to let me die." What's implied there? That's not right. That's not fair. Was God going to let him die? No. I mean, God's going to do another miracle here. But what is the default of our human nature, our flesh, our sin nature? Does our sin nature default to being thankful? Does it default to gratitude? Or do we default to complaining? Do we default to assuming the worst about other people or about our situation? Now, there's a few of you in here that at least what you say outwardly, you're a lot more positive and optimistic than I am. But, you know, many of us in here just kind of assume the worst anytime something comes up. Did God give him great deliverance to kill him? No. How could this prayer have been phrased differently? "Lord, you give me a great deliverance. Would you spare my life?" You don't have to, but would you? I mean, there's so many different ways that that could have been phrased to show a different attitude. But he said, now shall I die for thirst and fall in the hand of the uncircumcised? God gave him a victory over, you know, he killed 1,000 men, the rest of them ran away. We're going to blame this on Nathaniel, that the Wi-Fi connection keeps dropping. I have no other explanation for it. But no, in defense of Nathaniel, it happens when Brother Minion's back there too. The Minions are on vacation. They're gone for about, you know, a week and a half or something, which means anything that can go wrong will go wrong on the soundboard this week and next week when, you know, Brother Minion's not around to work on it. But here he says, you know, shall I fall into the hand of the uncircumcised? God didn't deliver him from the Philistines to turn around and hand him back over. It doesn't make any sense. But he's not thinking spiritually. He's not thinking in terms of faith. But, you know, he's doing what you and I would do. I've got a couple pictures I'm going to show here in a minute, so I'm going to try to reconnect it, Nathaniel. But you know, it may just be one of those days. But nonetheless, what did God do in verse 19? God clave a hollow place that was in the jaw, and there came water thereout. And when he had drunk, his spirit came again, and he revived. Man, that's a tremendous miracle, isn't it? If you ever think about how that actually happened, it's also kind of gross. Right? God gave him a miraculous source of water, and he got enough to drink. Now, why was drink so necessary? I mean, how long do you think it took him to kill 1,000 men? If you kill one a minute, how many hours is that? 10 hours? Something like that. If you kill two a minute, that's still 5 hours. Where do they live? I mean, this is, you know, in the middle of the desert, a desert climate. You know, this is extreme exertion. He's exhausted. He's dehydrated. He needed some water just to be able to function. If any of you have ever gotten dehydrated or close to it, you know what it does to you if you don't have enough water in your system. Nothing works right. Even sometimes your thinking gets a little clouded. But where did God put the drinking fountain? Okay, you ever go to a drinking fountain and you watch somebody in front of you get a drink and you're like, yeah, I don't need water that bad. I have. I'm like, I'll take my chances on whatever comes out of the faucet here. Where did this drinking water come from? The jawbone of a recently dead animal that has also been used as an instrument of self-defense to kill 1,000 men. You think that jawbone had blood on it? One way or the other it did. It was Philistine blood or donkey blood. Maybe some of Samson's blood, who knows? So he's got this, you know, bloody bone that he found on the ground and he picked up and he used it as a weapon. Then what does it say he did with it when he was finished with it? Verse 17, when he made an end of speaking, he cast away the jawbone out of his hand. When he's done and the Philistines are gone, he threw it back down in the dirt. So now when God gives him a drinking fountain, he has to pick it up back up out of the dirt, right? Maybe shouldn't pitch the fit. But here it says, God clave a hollow place in the jaw, and there came water thereout. You ever heard of that before?
No.
Ever heard of that since? No. What lesson should we draw from that? I mean, this is not intended to be a trick question, but what lesson should we draw from that? Just because you've never seen it done before doesn't mean that God can't or won't. I mean, a lot of times, you know, that's what the New Testament says, well, we walk by faith, not by sight. I mean, that's what we're supposed to do. But a lot of times, you know, we kind of limit our prayers or even our dreams of what God would do to what we've seen before, right? God took care of it. I mean, has God miraculously provided water before? Yeah, I mean, give me a famous example of when God had provided water prior to this time for his people. They both raised their hand. They didn't see each other. Good thing they gave the same answer, right? Moses, water from the rock. Okay, yeah. I mean, were there other examples? Sure. But, you know, God did water from the rock. You know, God parted the Red Sea for Moses. God parted moving water in the Jordan River for Joshua. What I'm saying is the miracles don't always look the same, but sometimes we think, well, my situation doesn't look like theirs, so mine won't turn out the same way. If God can give water, drinking water from a weapon of war, also known as a donkey's jawbone, then God can intervene in whatever you're in my circumstances too, right? It's an odd circumstance. I mean, he was thankful for the water. I mean, obviously if it was clean water, he could have used it to rinse off the dirt that I was talking about a minute ago. But a lot of times we just don't stop and think about, ooh, yeah, drinking water. Let me just drink this out of a donkey's jawbone. You know, that's the part we kind of just skip over when we read these things. Verse 19, there came out water thereout. When he had drunk, his spirit came again and revived. Wherefore the name of that was called thereof En Hakore, which is in Lehi, unto this day. En Hakore is, you know, literally the eye of the spring. So he named it the place of the spring, the eye being, you know, the center focal point of that. But he named it the place of the spring that God gave him. And, you know, some of the commentators or those that, you know, really like to write on the ancient names of the cities and stuff think that there's some similarity to some modern places to this ancient name here. Verse 20, and he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. So, Samson, his first act of judging Israel was born out of a spiritual zeal or a selfish zeal. What was his first public act of bringing judgment on the Philistines? What was it? What event was it related to? It's not a trick question. I'm going back to chapter 14. What event was his first, you know, act of judgment related to? The wedding. Remember? He went down and wanted to marry this Philistine girl and told his parents, you go get her for me. And he went down there to marry her. And, you know, he made a bet with his supplied groomsman. And she cried and begged and pleaded and nagged and whatever else until she got the answer out of him. And in anger, he went and killed 30 Philistines. So was that, you know, a spiritual motivation? No, it's selfishness. What was the next thing that he did to, you know, what we would call judgment? All right, he said, I'm not done with just that. I'm going to go, teach them a lesson, and then I'll be satisfied. Well, what happened? He went and caught 300 foxes, set them loose in the Philistines. Again, was that spiritually motivated? Okay, nope. Now, he killed 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of an ass. What happened there? Okay, the Philistines came after him. It was an act of self-defense. So what I'm saying is God used Samson, but a lot of the recorded events that we have are not, you know, high and lofty motivations. In fact, he shouldn't have been marrying a Philistine girl to start with. I point that out to say the next thing we see here in chapter 16 is kind of the same thing. Chapter 16, verse 1, then went Samson to Gaza and saw there a harlot and went in unto her. Okay? There is absolutely no way to defend this, you know, other than to say that, you know, he was where he wasn't supposed to be, okay, doing what he wasn't supposed to do. He was down in Gaza, okay, where is Gaza? Well, put the map up here. You can see on the left-hand side there on the coast of the Mediterranean, the lowest dot there on the side is Gaza. Right above that is Ashkelon. The next dot up the coast is Ashdod. Okay, and then you see just inland from that is Gath. Only one that's not labeled out there clearly that I want to point out is Ekron. Okay? But Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Gath, that section right there, those were the five royal, you add Ekron to that, that would be the five royal cities of the Philistines. Okay? Ashkelon, Ashdod, Gath, Gaza, and Ekron. We still hear about Gaza today, don't we? Same general area. Okay? But it says he went down to Gaza. What was he doing in Gaza? I mean, that's where I'm going with this. What was he doing in Gaza? I mean, if we go back to chapter 14, he was in Timnath. Chapter 14, verse 1, Samson went down to Timnath and saw a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistine. He came back and told mom and dad, get her for me. What was he doing in Timnath? What was he doing in Gaza? I mean, if I didn't have as much information as I have, I could say, well, maybe, you know, he's scouting out and he's looking for a weakness and he's looking for an opportunity to do something for the Lord to deliver them from the enemies of the people of Israel. But we have enough information in the Bible on Samson to know that Samson's motives were probably far less noble and less spiritual, right? What was he doing in Gath? He's still hanging out with the Philistines. Now, it says he judged Israel 20 years. When the angel appeared to his parents, it said he's going to begin to deliver Israel. But my point is this, there's not a lot of recorded instances where he was hanging out with Israel. There's a lot of recorded instances where he was hanging out with the Philistines. Okay, did God use it? Yes. But he did not completely deliver because, you know, there was limitations to this. But he went down to Gaza, and there he saw a harlot. I'm not saying there weren't any harlots in Israel. What I am saying is this, if you're where you're not supposed to be, the likelihood of temptation showing up there is greater. All right, now here's a temptation for something you know you're not supposed to do. Again, this was not something where he didn't know better. I mean, the Bible identifies her as a harlot. Samson recognized her as a harlot. And then that last phrase in verse 1 says, he went in unto her. Okay? That phrase is used several times in the Old Testament, and it always has the idea of marital relations, an intimate relationship. Okay, in fact, if you look back at chapter 15 and verse 1, it came to pass in a while after the time of wheat harvest, Samson visited his wife with a kid, and he said, I will go into my wife, into the chamber. That's when he found out that her dad said, I've already paid for the wedding, I'm not paying for another one, so he married her off to the best man when Samson left in a rage. But it's the exact same phrase there. We said he's going to go into his wife that we see here in chapter 16, verse 1. He went into the harlot. There's no other way to explain it. Okay? So, he's where he shouldn't be, doing what he shouldn't be doing. This is sin, and there's no justification or excuse for it. Verse 2, it was told the Gazites, saying, Samson has come hither. And they compassed him in and laid wait for him all night in the gate of the city, and were quiet all the night, saying, in the morning when it is day, we shall kill him. Okay. Why would you wait till the morning? I mean, militarily, tactically, doesn't the nighttime give you some advantages? Yeah. Now, obviously, they didn't have night vision and, you know, electric lights and things like that, that, you know, equipment that we have today, but why were they waiting for daylight? Maybe they were hoping to gather more of a crowd. Maybe they wanted to do that, but they were still scared of him. But notice here, did you catch the phrase in verse 2? Where did they wait for him? They laid wait for him all night where? In the gate of the city. Why is that significant? Because what's getting ready to happen in two verses? Okay, so they heard about it, and they're like, all right, we're just going to hang out here in the gate because this is the only way he can go out. We're going to catch him tomorrow morning. Why they didn't just go to her house, I don't know. Verse 3, Samson lay till midnight and arose at midnight. That phrase midnight, to us, we think, you know, 12 a.m. We think of a certain time on the clock. The term very literally means half the night. So halfway through the night, halfway between sundown and sunrise, in the middle of the night. So it's not necessarily 12 p.m. is what I'm saying. In our time, it could be 11, 12, 1, 2, 3. You know, it could be anywhere in there in the middle of the night. He arose and took the doors of the gate of the city and the two posts and went away with them, bar and all, and put them upon his shoulders and carried them up to the top of a hill that is before Hebron. Okay? Where were they laying wait for him? In the gate. Where did Samson go in the middle of the night? He went to the gate. Why didn't they stop him? They were afraid of him. I mean, they'd heard about him killing 1,000 men with a jawbone. They've heard about everything else that Samson's done. He went straight to that gate, looked at him, and nobody stopped him, and he went on. Now, it says he put it on a hill that is before Hebron. Before means kind of in front of or facing Hebron. So he may not have carried it all the way to Hebron, but he took it somewhere in that general direction. All right, now, again, I picked this particular map because it also labels Hebron. And where I've zoomed it in, you can see Gaza on the left. And if you keep coming all the way over, about two-thirds of the way across the tan section there, you see Hebron right here where it kind of turns and makes an arrow. This is actually a map of some of the conquests of Israel when they conquered the Promised Land, but it showed the city names that I was looking for. Okay? According to the scale on this map, the distance from Gaza to Hebron is approximately 30 to 35 miles. Okay? According to, you know, some of the other books that I looked at, some of them said, you know, it's 60 kilometers, which is about 35 to 40 miles. One commentary said he carried it about 10 miles and put it on top of a hill, which from the top of that hill, you could see the hill of Hebron. Okay? Whatever. Whether he took it all the way to Hebron or whether he took it somewhere that was, you know, close enough, it was in the region of Hebron, the point is he carried this thing for miles. I mean, the gate was the most secure part of the city, right? That was the symbol of strength. You had the walls, but the gate was the place of attack. It would be reinforced. I mean, those posts would be sunk way down in the ground, and those doors were thick. Often one person couldn't open it by themselves. It required a group of people, you know, depending on the size and weight of those doors. And the Bible says here in verse 3 that he picked up the door and the two posts and the bar. The bar that was across it to keep it from opening. He picked up all of that, put it on his shoulders, and carried it miles away. Now, did God enable him to do that? Yes. Why? I don't know. Other than the fact that God was using him to judge the Philistines. But let me turn this around another way. Did God use wicked, heathen, pagan kings to judge Israel? No, I mean, look at Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, look at all the kings of, you know, whether it's Babylon and Assyria and the different ones, even Rome. Were they all spiritual people? I mean, we expect more from Samson because he had godly parents and he was from Israel and he had the opportunity to be taught correctly and he knew better. But, I mean, in one sense, God used heathens to judge Israel in other terms. At other times, God used Samson. Okay, but Samson never was used to the full extent that he could have been if he'd been a spiritual and godly man. Now, just as a reminder, okay, Samson, we all think he probably looked like this. It's a lot more likely that Samson looked like this. Okay? Because they didn't look at him and go, oh, I see where his strength comes. I mean, what do they go to Delilah and say? Find out where his strength comes from. Okay? It was not obvious looking at him. I mean, if Jim Bray picked up the city gates and walked away, I mean, we'd all know it's because of his workout regimen. Okay? If I picked up the city gates and carried him away, everybody would be wondering, okay, something weird's going on here. He doesn't look like he ought to be able to do that. You know, they look at Samson and go, there's no explanation for this. Okay? Now, just a little more context here, verse 4. Came to pass afterwards that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. The lords of the Philistines came up to her and said, entice him and see wherein his great strength lieth, and by what means we may prevail against him, that we may bind him to afflict him. Okay? They looked at him and said, all right, we can't figure out where this is coming from. But you know, they weren't necessarily thinking in the same terms that you and I would be. I mean, I haven't read a lot of, you know, all the fables and mythology and that kind of thing. But, you know, from what I do understand and from what's reflected in modern, you know, stories and what's called science fiction and stuff like that, very often there are people that have special powers, right? Whether it's in mythology or whether it's in cartoons and science fiction. There are people that have special powers, but they don't have these special powers all the time, right? It's only when they put on this certain belt or this certain hat or this certain ring, or they have this certain chain around their, you know, there's some object that when they have this object, it gives them power. Sounds crazy, right? I mean, sounds like a cartoon, but there are people that really believe that. I mean, there's a lot of mythology that's built on that kind of thinking. You know, when this particular object was in their possession, it gave the person what we would call superpowers. Okay? Well, they haven't been able to figure it out. It's not like he wears a chain with a medallion around his neck. It's like, oh, well, that's got to be it. I mean, it's not, you know, it wasn't obvious to them. They're like, okay, there has to be some sort of sorcery, some sort of witchcraft, some sort of magical powers going on here. We've got to figure out what it is. I think in the Philistine mindset, you know, that's more where they're coming from. There's some sort of spell going on here. There's some sort of source of power. And we got to figure out what's going on here. But what was the opening? Now, you see, all right, God used Samson to carry away the gates of Gaza, and then immediately we're introduced to Delilah, and Delilah was the means of his downfall. You cannot flout God's judgment. Okay? He went to a harlot. You know, he's flouting the lifestyle that he knows pleases God. Well, God's going to make sure that that becomes his downfall. Verse 4, came to pass afterwards that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. Okay, now, there's some, I was like, man, I wonder what her name means. Well, you know, some of the Bible names have some really significant meanings. Couldn't find any, you know, really specific definitions here. The closest we could get, or the closest I could find, was actually looking at similar words in other languages of the region, not necessarily in Hebrew, but in, you know, some of the other languages like Chaldee or Arabic. There's an Arabic word that sounds very, very similar. That word means flirtatious or forward, you know, behavior of, you know, a woman. I mean, to me, that sounds like Delilah. I mean, sounds like how she presented herself. But nonetheless, Delilah, he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. Okay? How many names of Hebrew women are we given that Samson fell in love with? I mean, every woman that was in Samson's life is a Philistine woman. What does that tell us about his appetites? That's where his focus was. That's where his interests were. I mean, when he went to his parents and said, hey, there's a woman down here in Timnath, get her to me to wife, what was his parents' response? Don't we have girls in Israel? Why do you have to go down to the Philistines? You know, but this was a constant, it was a weak spot that was constantly exploited in Samson's character. It was a character flaw, okay? Not that, you know, Philistines aren't worthy of salvation or anything like that, but God had specifically told his people not to intermarry with the people around them because religiously they would contribute to their downfall. They would teach them their idolatry and so forth. It came to pass afterward that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. The lords of the Philistines came up unto her and said unto her, entice him, see wherein his great strength lieth, by what means we may prevail against him, that we may bind him to afflict him. And we will give thee, every one of us, 1,100 pieces of silver. Now, how many lords of the Philistines were there? It says the lords, plural. Okay? I'm assuming, because there were five royal cities of the Philistines, and those are the ones that are constantly mentioned, I'm assuming that the lords of the Philistines here includes five men. You had five leaders of the different cities. Okay? So, and they said, each one of us will give you 1,100 pieces of silver. So what's the total silver that's being offered to Delilah here? 5,500 pieces. Okay? Now, this is obviously a long time before the New Testament. But, you know, when you have the silver coins, you know, or sometimes they were silver, they were called a penny. To us, a penny is copper now. But, you know, you have those coins that were called a penny. That one coin was a day's wage. Okay, so just for simple terms, for a minute, let's assume that we're talking about one coin that represents a day's wage. How many, so 5,500 days is how many years? Approximately 15 years. 15 to 16 years. So assuming that one piece of silver was a day's wage, they offered her what the average person, 15 years salary in one lump sum. Okay, now, it's possible that those pieces of silver could have been a little more or less than that. I'm just trying to get us to think here. Who or what did Delilah love more? Samson or money? Yeah. She did not love Samson. If she had an interest in him, she was far more interested in the money. But what I want you to also understand is when they said, we're going to give you 1,100 pieces of silver, that was from multiples. I mean, you're talking big money. Somebody came up and offered you 15 years salary to do something. You'd at least listen to them, right? Okay? Well, unless you're like, oh, my salary's zero, so, you know, it wouldn't help me any. But, you know, somebody offers you 15 years salary in a lump sum, I'm at least going to hear them out. I may have to say no. They want me to do something illegal or immoral. I got to say no. But I'm at least going to, okay, I'm intrigued. Go on. Here, they said, they were very specific. They didn't just say entice him. Because they've had him trapped before, right? In Gaza, he was trapped. They laid wait in the gate of the city, and that didn't help him. They didn't just say entice him. They said entice him. Find out where his great strength lieth. But there was another component to this. And by what means we may prevail against him. In other words, find out the source of his strength and find out the antidote, the Achilles heel. Find out the countermeasure that helps us to overcome that. They were very specific. Maybe they knew Delilah well enough to know that, you know, she was kind of a slick personality and they had to be very, very specific or she would, you know, not do exactly what they said. You entice him, you find out where strength cometh, and you find out what is the door that we can enter through to counter his great strength. You find that out, we'll give you a whole pile of money. I mean, and later on in the chapter, when she, you know, two or three times he lied to her, and finally when he told her the truth, she contacted him and said, hey, he showed me all his heart. You come up this time, this is the real deal. And it says that the lords of the Philistines showed up, what? With money in their hand. Okay? This was all transactional. This was not relationship. This was not true love. This was all transactional here. But what was the source of Samson's ultimate downfall? The sins he thought he was getting away with. Sensuality, worldliness, self-will. Presumption, well, God's delivered me before, God will deliver me again. All of those things, sensuality, self-will, pride, and presumption, all of those things that he's exhibited in his life up till now, those very traits become the means of his downfall. The New Testament says it this way, be sure your sin will, well, that's the Old Testament, be sure your sin will find you out. The New Testament verse that I was looking for was, be not deceived, God is not mocked, whatsoever man soweth, that shall he also reap. So Samson didn't get away with it forever. Anyway, time's up. We've got to stop there for today. Let's close in prayer. Thank you, Lord, for the examples, both positive and negative. And Lord, I pray that you'd help us to learn from these things, that you can intervene in circumstances and help us, Lord, not to limit your power in our own prayer and our own thinking. And Lord, I pray that as well you'd help us to learn the warning tales from Samson. Lord, help us not to operate in self-will or presumption, but Lord, help us to be obedient to you and see your blessings. We pray now for the service to come that you'd bless it in a special way. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you, and you're dismissed.